got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines.
Hello everybody, welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here with you as always. Kevin, what's up, man?
Oh, nothing. Just enjoying the transition into warmer weather and, you know, all the good things that come with that. And the excitement that I just put in a new apple orchard. And now I rented a trencher, which is fun because I will be able to scar the earth to run pipe. And I got to rent another thing at the tool rental place, which my bucket list is, I want to rent every tool they have.
Awesome. Hey, that's what? Scar the Earth sounds like another ironic punk band name. We really need to start this punk band because I think that'd be awesome. It'd be like Scar the Earth because everyone else scars the earth. So we're going to tell you all about it.
Well, it ties in with one of our stories today, I guess. But that's because there's some names that they really need to work on there. But yeah, I'm kind of on the other side of punk bands. I played in Red Lobster Cult, which, and gosh, I played in a lot of good ones. Insane War Tomatoes, which you can find on YouTube.
I heard you talking with Rogan about that years ago. Yeah. That was so funny, dude. The song titles, and there's one where you actually sing the chorus, isn't there?
I just have a couple little blurbs in there here and there, but that's just on the stuff that's online. I mean, there's a lot we recorded that it's just lost, and it's unfortunate because this was back on analog tapes, and the guy who ran the place had a stroke, and we could have bought the tapes for $75, but we didn't have $75, so they went in the dumpster, I guess. So, you know, sad, and we kind of lost that stuff forever, but a little bit lives on, and that holds up pretty well too, so. Yeah, if that's online, but Red Lobster Cult played in Dangling Units. We were good. Yeah, I was like 14, 15 playing in bars in Chicago. It was good times. We opened up for bands like, Circle Jerks and, God, who else? A lot of local stuff like Effigies and, a lot of other big national acts, but good times.
That's impressive, man. I mean, for those who don't know, Circle Jerks is a big name, or at least was in the punk scene for a long time. So,
yeah. Enough of them. We'll do another whole recap of punk rock someday, but on with the show.
Yeah, man. Yeah. We'll talk music at another date. Okay. Three stories. We've got some controversy to get into today. So first up, silencing science. NC State cancels panel discussion to appease woke activists. Next up. There is a solution to the devastating poultry pandemic, but anti-technology groups and outdated regulations are blocking it. And finally, here, CRISPR critter, how to gene edit a hypoallergenic cat. All very, very interesting topics today, Kevin. First up, though, I think this is the first story we've ever talked about that actually has you as one of the subjects.
And it's a tough one to talk about because it was a horrible situation, really kind of tragic. And, you know, in a way I really wish we didn't cover, but in a way there, we could talk about things that are important. I was scheduled to do a talk with a couple of other faculty, for the Genetic Engineering and Society Center at North Carolina State University, which I adore, and they do great work and it's a needed resource. I love what they do. One of my former students she wasn't exactly my student. I helped get her here from Nigeria. She was in our program for a while at University of Florida. She graduated, went to NC State. So she's there. And I really recommended that place. And so I really have a very good relationship with the concept and the faculty, and I just adore it. So when I was asked by one of the students, a student from Ghana, actually, who asked me if I could speak there, I was happy to do it. Well, the whole thing went down. I was supposed to speak on the use of persuasion and rhetoric and blah, 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 and crafting narratives in science communication. The whole other two folks were talking about storytelling, which is kind of a topic I don't really like very much for a couple reasons, but anyway, long story short, everything's good. We're getting ready to go. They advertise it on Twitter, which is when things go bad. Because now a couple of folks see this who feel like, and I'm just my opinion, that this should not happen because I'm involved. And so they get on shaming Twitter, shaming the university program by saying, it looks like three men on a panel, three white men on a mantle, and, you know, making this into a controversy where it was really chosen by a diverse group of students for diverse opinions and positions on a matter, and maybe didn't satisfy all the check boxes for, you know, it, you know, could have had a little more diversity in the panel itself. But at a wider scope, this session was part of a semester long effort that was very diverse and has many different people of different ethnic backgrounds and whatever, you know, males and females. So long story short was that, you know, it's always weird to see just a all male panel. And I guess, you know, that, but there was three guys. So the chances of it happening by chance are what, 1 in 8, right? And it happened. So the problem is that the people who called it out were not part of the program. They were not attending the talks. They had no interest in the talks. They just didn't want it to happen. And the note I got from them that canceled is the part that was the tip off where they said, well, it was this, but then we learned some other things about you that we don't necessarily, aren't exactly savory things or whatever it was. I don't remember the language, which means that we know who the usual suspects are who call ahead on conferences or things I'm speaking at and kind of poison the well. And most of the times it doesn't matter. This time, since it was a student run event, they probably saw, you know, they probably freaked out and said, this is going to get us in trouble or we just don't know. So let's just cancel the event. So long story short, education didn't happen. And a opportunity to learn something new to the students that chose the speakers didn't happen. And so the act of, and I don't want to say, you know, I hate saying cancellation, but it is literally what they did. They got an educational event canceled because they didn't like the panel. And this is where we are right now. And we can, you know, well, I can just end there and hear your thoughts. And then, you know, maybe we could put a bow on it, but, you know, nothing bad to say about the organization themselves, other than I really wish they wouldn't capitulate to essentially terrorists, people who are going to use media to assassinate the people that they don't want speaking or they don't want to hear from. And doing it because of ideological reasons. And so anyway, I'll stop there.
Well, let me jump in and offer a few comments. And I just want to read these tweets. These are the tweets that got this event canceled. I'm not going to use names, but if you go to the story, and I wrote the story, by the way, because no one else wrote about it. So I feel like, you know, the word needs to get out about foolishness like this when it happens. But the critics were saying things like this. Between the all-white male panel and the highly problematic participants, this is a pretty disappointing move by at GES Center. So it already carries this sort of finger-wagging, like, you know, we do not approve of this decision. I'm like, who are you people to talk like that? And valiantly, the GES Center tried to defend the panel at first. They said, look, this is the first all-white male panel we've had in ages. As you said, we have a very diverse student body that invited these speakers. Just by luck of the draw, every once in a while, there's going to be a few white guys that have some insights to share with our students. And so they defended it for, I want to say it was close to a week. And then they started getting more pushback. So then someone else responded to their tweet and said, behold, the attempted defense of an all-white mantle in its natural habitat. Get it? It's so clever, right? So 4 days go by or so, and then they issue this email cancellation, and they gave the reasons that you said, Kevin. And then once the event got canceled, these people were celebrating. And this is another tweet. This person says, this is freaking awesome. They listened to the feedback and canceled a problematic mantle. This is a shining example of what to do. Good job with 3 exclamation marks. Okay. So I just have a couple of points I want to make here. The first is that this is infants running the show. This is letting children dictate what everyone else is going to do. And I just find that so frustrating and frankly appalling, you know. And the bigger problem that I have is that everybody that I know in academia, people that work at universities or they work in a scientific field, they know the value of science communication. And they talk about it. If you read a journal like Nature, for example, they will say things like, if the public doesn't understand the value of our work, they're not going to vote people into office that are going to fund science research. And then where are we? We're stuck. There's, you know, this is a very serious problem if you work in a scientific field. And then you'll see journals. I think this is Nature as well. Yeah, this is Nature as well. They'll say things like, you got to be persuasive. You got to be engaging. You got to tell stories. And, you know, whether you're trying to sell a product or win a grant, you know, you got to get public support for your work. So everyone understands the value of science outreach. And then you come to an event like this and it gets shut down because I don't know if people are scared or they have some sympathy ideologically with this kind of stuff. But the bigger problem is that the public doesn't accept this by and large. And I'm referring to a poll that The Atlantic published last November. And it's somewhere between 50 and 60% of people think the culture is too politically correct. And they think cancel culture is a big problem. Now, whether you agree or disagree is not the point. The point is, if you are in the sciences and you're trying to engage the public and your message is ensconced in this kind of social justice rhetoric and the public sees events getting canceled, they see people getting fired, they see people calling Darwin a racist who was, you know, trying to disguise his racism in his scientific work. This is all absurd. And so when people see this, they're going to reject your message, whatever it is. If you're talking about vaccines or genetic engineering or masking or whatever the topic is, they're not going to listen to what you say. And then the same people who will kowtow to these activist figures like this, then they will turn around and go, you know, why do people believe all this misinformation? The public just doesn't listen to us. And this is a perfect example of why, because they see you giving into this. So this is a serious problem. And I know it's difficult. It's hard for people to, you know, risk, I don't know, your job or, you know, being shamed publicly. But I mean, this really has to stop because no one's going to listen to us if this takes precedent over doing science communication.
No, you're exactly right. And the thing you have to stop doing is stop canceling events and stop apologizing. Do the right thing. And if someone says it would be nice if this had a little more diversity, look at it and say, you know what? You're right. Next one, we're going to do an all-female one. We're going to balance this out. It was just a dumb luck of the draw. We'll balance that out. Or we'll add a couple people. But don't cancel educational events because somebody complains. You know, I mean, think about that for a minute. Don't burn books because somebody doesn't like the content of them. Don't do it. And worst of all, the people who are making these kinds of comments are not people who are creating communications products. They're not enhancing the environment for us to learn and for us to do good things. Actually, one of them has an affiliation with an all-woman group that does really decent work as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, the bottom line is they're not regularly producing good work. And if they don't like what we were talking about, produce more information, produce some more media and connect it to it, you know, link it to it, share it with the Twitter followers who are following those tweets. We have this network that we can use to have a good conversation, but that conversation can't happen when you say, stick your fingers in your ears, and then you stick your fingers in my ears and stick your fingers in my students' ears and say, this is not going to happen because we don't like you and we don't like this, the way that this panel looks.
And I saw a little bit of a response to the story, nothing of substance really, but I saw comments like, you know, we weren't silencing science. We were correcting bad behavior. You know, this is not us canceling anything. Cause I guess they rescheduled the panel for later this year, but presumably they're going to change the panelists. But it's so funny to me that like you could engage in something that's just so blatantly malicious and then go, we didn't do anything. We're just correcting bad behavior. I think that's just so preposterous. And the fact that it was the students that wanted this, and you have, I don't know, you have knighted yourself protector of everything, or, you know, Judge Judy, I don't know. And then you're going to step in and say, no, see, you can't hear this person speak because they're problematic according to my ideology. That's just absurd. I don't know what else I could say. It drives me bonkers, Kevin.
No, that's where we're at. And I think it's not correcting bad behavior. It's using bad behavior to stop things that you don't agree with. And instead of letting it happen and create your own art and let's have a conversation, just shut down the conversation that you don't want to happen or the people you don't want to have an opportunity. And I know who it is. I mean, it's the same people who've harassed me for years, and that's fine. I mean, that's where it goes. The problem is, you know, the student who asked me, he didn't know that I remember him from a previous meeting, and I remembered exactly who he was. He didn't know that we had met. So he had much more impact on me than I did on him. And he was really impressive. And he called me that night. I don't want to say almost in tears, but very emotional, that he felt very bad and very responsible for the fact that this was canceled and wished that there was something he could do. And I told him, overall, you probably learned the best lesson in communication than if it were as to have happened, because you see the power of the people who hate certain things being communicated by certain people, and you see how not to respond to it. You don't give it to them. You don't show weakness, and you don't apologize. You push forward. You do what's right. You fix the next panel. You whatever it takes, but you don't interrupt the flow of good science that's working to communicate and train others.
There you go, folks. Don't let the terrorists win. I think that's the very last line of my article, and it's a quote from you. I love that so much.
But it's true. It's true. I mean, this is people who are using essentially coercion to accomplish their goal. They're saying, they basically, it's an implicit threat. If you go ahead with this, we are going to show that it is discrimination. We are going to show your organization is sexist, and those kinds of things stick around forever. And so they know that those kinds of allegations work. And instead of saying, you know, it would be, you know, we love what you do, this is a great organization, would it be okay to add another female? I know my old student who's there at NC State, my former student was on her committee. You could have plugged her into that panel and she would have went with it because she's good. And she would have given a very excellent opinion that would have been extremely welcome from an African woman. And she would maybe have some different perspectives to share. But anyway, that's the right move to make. We've spent way too much time on this, much more than I wanted to, but, support that organization and don't cancel science talks. You can see I'm kind of disturbed by it all because I don't ever want this to sound like I'm throwing them under the bus. I love the faculty there. It's a great university and the GES is a great program. So, you know, I my heart is with them and I do think I will never be asked back.
And that's a shame, but there's lots of opportunities in the world. So, plenty of fish in the sea, whatever stupid metaphor you want to use, but we're done. We're done. I think we said our piece, Kevin. Let's talk about another genetic engineering solution to a real problem that we might never see. What's going on here?
Yeah, this is a really important one that hits close to home, literally. We raise poultry, chickens, ducks, geese, and turkeys. And the threat of avian influenza is something that's very real right now. It's been detected in 24 states. It's the highest levels that they've identified since 2015. And something like 23 million birds have already been destroyed. It's early in the season. So you're talking primarily turkeys and chickens that spread this highly contagious disease among viral disease. And chickens, mostly layers and broilers. So, you know, the ones you're eating, the ones that are making your eggs, when this hits these operations, all of the birds have to be destroyed. And same with turkeys. And so this is really going to potentially affect food prices and food availability for certain key staples, such as chicken and eggs. This is really an important issue. It's spread by wild birds that along their flight paths coming back in the spring, stop and maybe get some water or stop near a facility or maybe end up getting into a facility somehow or feces or dust or whatever. There's ways that this virus moves. And even with really tight biosecurity, these facilities that raise the animals sometimes can be in danger. Places like ours where everything is free range and has, you know, water is outside, you have birds coming down to take a drink all the time. And that can actually be extremely dangerous to a flock. So we've had to clamp down and go to other types of measures, and it's a real pain, but this is what we have to do because we have not accepted a genetic engineering solution. So in 2011, folks at Cambridge and University of Edinburgh, the Roslin Institute, came up with a chicken that if it caught avian flu, avian influenza, it couldn't spread it. So patient zero got infected, but it never went further than that. That was 2011. We're 11 years later, and that has gone nowhere towards commercialization. So that's the real sad story.
Couple of interesting things just to give people some context. And this is a quote from your article. So you at GLP, by the way, where you can read this. So you write, in 2015, over 50 million domestic chickens and turkeys were lost to this infection with an estimated value of $3.3 billion. So this is tremendous. So if you work in this industry, if you raise these animals, this is a tremendous cost to you. And if you are a consumer of the end products like eggs and meat, this means higher food prices for you. So this is a real consequence, and it has real costs for everybody. But then in your summary just now, you said that even your birds, which are free range, can still get infected. And I think this is something we should dig into a little bit, because groups like the Center for Food Safety, these other pro-organic groups, you know, anti-factory farming outfits, they will say, well, you know, we just need to get rid of this industrial farming model that perpetuates the spread of disease. But that doesn't seem to be the case. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, the organic rules for certification of animals, I'm not an expert in this area, but they do require a certain amount of access to free ranging. And at least access to it. They don't necessarily have to be outside, but they do have to have access to it. The problem is that does open you up to biosecurity risks. And, you know, we've had people who have had a chicken that had a health problem, and they'll throw it over our fence and say, oh, they got chickens. They'll figure out what's wrong with this one. And now you just put a sick bird into our flock that all kinds of really nasty pathogens that can be introduced. And, you know, and so we when you're looking at factory level, I don't want, you know, and I mean factory in a good way. We make iPhones in a factory. We make cameras in a factory and computers in a factory and cars in a factory. And we're fine with that. A large operation that has efficiency can be a good thing. And in the case of poultry farming, large operations have more opportunities for biosecurity. They have opportunities to close off those areas and keep birds in a covered space with water and food that is not accessible to foreign birds. And in this way, you really limit the access to disease and the spread of potential disease that can also be zoonotic. So this thing can actually infect humans, dogs. It's been found in ferrets. So bird flu can move in other species. So really, really interesting stuff around this disease that really says doing this in a more secure facility is the best thing you can do. And even that's not good enough.
Okay. So no matter the specifics or the specifications of how you're raising these animals, it's still a risk to you. And I think you actually wrote that vaccination isn't a great solution because the virus undergoes antigenic shift or drift, right? So
right.
It's really hard to, and I think that's similar to the COVID shots. It's difficult to get one that will stop transmission because the virus mutates so much that it's just not effective. So that's not a great solution. But this genetic engineering approach is great. So without getting too technical, can you just explain the basics of what they do to immunize the birds against this predator?
Yeah, well, absolutely. So this is better than immunization. So there are some other strategies. Immunization has been thought of, and one of the things they can do is engineer things like duckweed that wild birds will eat with a conserved part of the H1N5 protein. And because there is a conserved part of this virus which doesn't shift too much. And that's been shown to work a little bit, but it's never been released into the wild. The way that this innovation works, and this is really slick, the virus itself replicates by having a couple of different sequences in its genomic sequence, which grab all of the proteins necessary to make the next virus, just like to copy the genetic material. Let's say that they have sequences that sequester the factors that are necessary to create the next strand of DNA genetic sequence. What this group did was they made chickens that contained just that sequence. So it grabbed a hold of all the replication machinery, but there was nothing to replicate. So it was a little decoy that said, come over and stick on me. I'm the sequence that is the beginning of where replication starts, but there was nothing else there to replicate. So essentially it siphoned off all of the factors that were required for viral replication onto this decoy molecule and had zero effect on the bird itself. So the first bird would get sick because it already had the virus, but it couldn't spread it because it could replicate the virus. Really, really cool technology. And the thing is, you'd have to engineer essentially one bird to do this. And once you had one bird, you could mate it against others and have an entire flock of birds that carried this little decoy molecule that if the avian influenza virus came along, wouldn't allow it to replicate. Super cool technology.
And just so we can put it on the record, this, as far as we can tell, it doesn't affect the quality of the meat, it doesn't affect eggs. There appears to be no risk to consumers of these products, right? So this helps the animals, stops the spread of diseases that can jump between species, as you said, and directly it's going to lower the costs for producers, and then that's going to get passed on to consumers. So this seems like a win for everybody, Kevin. So what's going on here? Why is this not being commercialized?
Well, it's probably the usual that, you know, the rules in the EU and the rules in the USA, North America, are extremely biased against animal agriculture and genetic engineering in animals. In the EU, forget about it. It can never happen. That under the current rules, it's almost impossible. In the US, in North America, a single base change in DNA of an animal means now you have to treat it like a drug. And it has to go through the drug approval process, not just, you know, is it safe to eat? It has to go through all of the clinical trials, all the stuff like drugs. So it's essentially an archaic system that stops this thing from ever being introduced. The proof of concept is good. It looks like it could save money for consumers, could help poultry farmers, and save millions of birds from being bulldozed into a pit and covered with dirt. I mean, But, you know, this is the frustration for me as a scientist. They tell us to solve problems and we go solve them. And then once we solve them, they say, okay, we can't use it.
And to that point, you said something really interesting in here. And you basically said that there are activist groups who have pressured the FDA, who is the regulatory authority on animal gene editing. And they have in no uncertain terms threatened litigation against the FDA. And sure, the FDA doesn't want to spend its time in court, right? It doesn't want to spend the money. It doesn't want to send its lawyers in there. It wants to regulate drugs because that's what it's supposed to do. So they're afraid of getting into this legal fight. So they're being ultra conservative in their regulation. And it's really because you have this handful of groups and that the political figures they're connected to, both here and in Europe, who are willing, like just like in our last story, they're willing to step in and say, well, you know, this isn't good for you. I know better than you. Let me step in, consumer, scientist, and I'm going to take care of this for you, you know. go buy some organic chicken. That's really the answer. And it's so absurd and it's so frustrating. So weigh in, Kevin. I mean, this directly affects your work to a certain extent. So,
well, ultimately it does, because all the innovations that we do that are now sitting on the shelf that never get to the people they're meant to serve is really frustrating. And it really, I think, deters people from getting involved in chasing their heart, which is really to solve problems for people and for the environment. But because we know they never will see the light of day, you really are turned off to the idea. Who needs another proof of concept that we can make biofortified vegetables or, you know, or better quality animals that don't get sick? You know, I mean, they can do it with swine. They can now with a porcine respiratory and reproductive virus, which is another huge problem there. They can do it. I believe they're making inroads with East African swine fever virus. All these animal viruses that are insidious, making some progress in fixing them. But until you can get folks like the Center for Food Safety and all the other organizations that just abhor biotechnology out of that equation, good solutions are never going to be implemented. And it's a heartbreaker.
What can we say? I don't know. How many times, Kevin, on this show have we had to say, great technology, not ready for primetime. Great technology, not being allowed to be used. Great technology, but the public, it's over and over again. It's more than annoying or fresh. I don't know.
Yeah. How the hell do we get a COVID vaccine so fast?
I know. I was about to say, you know, maybe another war will start and we'll get a big chicken shortage and then Europe will go, okay, fine. You could do it. Obviously I don't want another war though, because war is bad. Okay. Well, let's end on a happier note, which would be possibly a hypoallergenic cat.
Yeah, this is great. I love this. And so a hypoallergenic cat, and this is probably another one you'll never see in the EU. So the French and the Germans will walk around with swollen eyes and lots of boogers. There's a certain significant number of people that are allergic to cats. It's something like 15% of the population. And it's because of a protein called FEL-D1. And this protein, that's the gene, and then the protein that it encodes forms this weird polymeric protein that's called secretoglobin. And secretoglobin, they don't really know what it does. They just know that you can find it in the saliva and in other parts of the animal's exudates. So this thing shows up like around anus glands and that kind of thing. But, you know, but mostly the eyes and mouth, and it may have some sort of antibacterial function. Who knows? But secretoglobin is the stuff that they make. And this is the reason that people get itchy when a cat comes around, because a cat licks itself to, you know, clean itself. And so you pet that cat and get secretoglobin on you. And then you touch your eyes or you breathe it in. And then all of a sudden you have an allergic reaction. Well, this group, and I can't remember the name of the company now, InBio, it's Nicole F. Brackett, Dr. Brackett, like on emergency, Dr. Brackett. She and her group have managed to edit the gene out, so the FEL-D1 gene, so that the cat doesn't make this protein. And this is a conserved protein across cats. You find it in everything from tigers to house cats, but it seems to have some sort of evolutionary advantage to it, whatever. But probably in a domestic cat, maybe isn't so necessary, because they don't need the protections that wild cats do. So if this protein had some sort of antibacterial, antimicrobial function, or, you know, maybe anti-mammalian function, maybe that doesn't matter if it's lost. So, excuse me, I got a little cough there. So they've managed to edit this thing out. And now you have hypoallergenic cats. And it seems to work. So that's the interesting story.
Now, I believe, and again, maybe this is, maybe I'm on acid right now and I'm contemplating a hypothetical world, but the FDA would have to approve something like this in the United States too. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, this would have to be approved as a drug under the current legislation. So
that's so that's stupid. Right.
I know. It's really a bummer, and it probably would have to do every single cat that would, you know, 'cause you wouldn't just do one species, right? You'd do, or one breed, you'd do a couple different breeds, yeah, whatever. But it's something that would have to go through approval process. It would never happen in Europe. So this is the kind of innovation that is possible. I'm guessing that in bio, and I've tried getting them on the Talking Biotech podcast, but they said, not yet. We'll talk soon. So I think they've got some irons in the fire and probably are dealing with deregulation issues and probably don't want to, you know, screw that up by spilling the beans on a popular science podcast.
Fair enough. I don't blame them for that. I guess more to the acceptance of this issue, and this is an ancient point that's been made for 30 years now, but we breed cats all the time, right? So you have, I mean, I don't know how many different kinds of cats there are today. It's got to be, I don't know, hundreds, maybe thousands. I don't know. But it's like, whatever would keep people from letting this go through regulatory approval, it's like, you can't do that because you're changing the DNA of cats. But we do that all the time already. I don't know. That's right. I'm just kind of out of things to say. I'm all disheveled over this, Kevin.
Well, you know, the other ways that you can solve this problem, they do have some cat foods that suppress this thing. So it's like there's a protein in chicken eggs, in the yolk of eggs, that has antibodies against this protein. It's kind of weird that that evolved like that. And so you actually can neutralize this thing in the spit, in the saliva of the cat, by giving it certain food. So if you have allergies to cats, you can give the cat certain food that'll break, you know, stop this. The other thing you can do is give your cat a bath frequently. And which is good. I mean, some, you know, some cats absolutely hate it. Some cats like it. Big problem is you get hair all over your tongue. But in general, it's almost got away with it.
Oh man!
Yeah, thank you, Steve Martin, on that one. That's an old Steve Martin joke.
That's disgusting. If anyone has a cat, you know that's disgusting.
Well, it does look like this, you know, the beauty of this is that it just shows again that we can use these technologies to do good things to help people and help people live better lives and enjoy time with their domestic feline companions. It's good technology that will probably make a difference in the future. And we should be very excited to revise the rules to help new technologies reach the people they were meant to serve. And that's the last two stories today in a nutshell.
Good stuff. Well, who are you following on Twitter, or what are you following on Twitter?
I am going to recommend that people follow the GES Center, Genetic Engineering and Society Center at North Carolina State University. They are at GES Center, NCSU. And they're a wonderful organization that not only brings in scientists, but associates social scientists that have excellent ideas as to how we can best implement the technologies that are described and that are promoted by the scientists associated. So definitely follow the GES Center. You know, they're really worth your time to follow. So let me just leave it with that. And then who are you following, Cameron?
What do you call that? A science hug, Kevin?
I call that. Well, you know what? It's really horrible because I know they'll never invite me back. And at the same time, I love what they do. And so it puts you in a really funny situation. But I can't control that. What I can control is the stuff I produce and control the media that we produce and the messaging we do. And I will continue to do that. And in fact, because of this, I'm going to turn it up another notch. you know, I mean, where my students are recording videos next week, and I'm going to start doing videos this summer on a series of scientific and professional topics. And that was mostly motivated by this. So, you know, too bad. We're going to do more now and make people even angrier.
How dare he get out there and inform the public about complicated but important issues? That is just over the line. Okay. If you're on Twitter this week, which most of you are, I'm sure, follow the hashtag MedTwitter, M-E-D Twitter. And this is just like a giant collection of doctors and nurses and people that work in healthcare talking. And I found out about this from someone else I've recommended previously. I think you've recommended her too. And that's Liza Dunn.
Oh yeah. She's awesome.
Yeah. She does great work, of course, on the outreach side of things and as a scientist. But every once in a while on Twitter, I see her retweet something and the hashtag MedTwitter's on it. And it's primarily because she's trying to get doctors to think differently about genetic engineering or something. So there's all kinds of cool discussions going on at that hashtag. So check that out. I think you'll benefit.
Or use the pound symbol.
Yes. If you're older than 40, it's pound symbol MED Twitter. If you're a millennial or younger, it's hashtag med Twitter.
Thank you. Or if you're really old, tic-tac-toe board.
Oh, hey, by the way, I got not just an email, but a phone call from someone earlier this week who listens to the show. And she said, hey, you guys really are funny because really? Yeah. And not that we were walking around doubting ourselves, but she said, it doesn't sound like you have prepared jokes. It just sounds like you guys have a good rapport and you have a great conversation. And I said, that's exactly what we go for. So
I don't know if anyone can tell, but I don't prepare anything. I mean, cause that's the mechanism. You send like six stories or so on like Wednesday, and then we decide on three, or I pick three and send that back. And then we just talk about them. And I read them and, you know, maybe do a little more research here and there, but in general, it's pretty much off the cuff. So yeah, good times. Appreciate the listeners.
Yeah. I promise that Kevin never sends me an email and says, hey, at 27:14 of the next episode, I'm going to make a cat bathing joke. That's not part of the prep. Okay. We try to get the science right, but we don't prep jokes. Anyways, we're done. Everyone have a terrific week. Follow us as well at Kevin Folta on Twitter, at ACSH.org to get my writing, my website, CameronJEnglish.net. geneticliteracyproject.org. Follow the GLP because they put this whole thing on for us. And with that, we'll see you next time.